This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk with 6th District Congressman Derek Kilmer. One of the things that's on my mind, nothing to do with you, I don't think, but there was all this talk over the weekend about dark MAGA. You familiar with the term?
I just heard the term from one of my colleagues.
Yeah. So this is Madison Cawthorn, lost his primary, and he's saying that we're going dark now. And I just want to know, is this anything I have to worry about, or is he just spouting off because he's angry?
I am concerned about any sort of stream of belief or perspective in this country that's focused on violence or hatred. You know, and unfortunately, we've seen a fair amount of that. We've seen that lead to terrible violence in Buffalo this last week. We've seen, unfortunately, the consequences of that on the 6th of January of last year. So, you know, from my perspective, we've already seen a fair amount of darkness out of that fringe on the very far right. And I think every American should be concerned about those who might want to perpetuate hatred or violence. I actually give my colleague Liz Cheney great credit this week. She actually received a award for political courage, which unfortunately has been often lacking in our nation's capital. But she spoke out about the importance of calling this type of rhetoric out and making sure that people are standing up to it. And I don't think you've seen that happen adequately in the Republican Party in Washington, D.C.
The other thing that has me a little concerned is I hear some of the Republican state candidates talking openly about challenging election results. If we see fraud, but in, you know, we did a lot of checking for fraud and we found like a handful of cases. Is that also? I'm trying to give people some perspective on what they should get really worried about, Congressman. So, is it a real concern that there are candidates who, if they became governor or if they became a secretary of state, would actually basically make up charges of fraud for the purpose of throwing yet another presidential election into confusion?
Well, let me give two examples that I am concerned about. There are candidates for county auditor in the state of Washington that are running on an agenda that's focused more on trying to determine a specific outcome rather than on making sure that there's a free and fair election. I think that's concerning. You know, we have a terrific county auditor in Mason County, as an example, who I think, you know, calls balls and strikes as he sees them without an agenda towards trying to jerry-rig an outcome. But I think that's concerning that there are candidates who have a different perspective.
Let's talk about other concerns. Roe v. Wade. It must be frustrating for the House to pass bill after bill after bill just to have it die in the Senate. What are your feelings about the next steps for Roe v. Wade ahead of the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I'm concerned about it, and it's why the House has passed the Women's Health Protection Act to codify Roe v. Wade into law, which our state has done, thankfully. But, you know, obviously there's real concern that too many states haven't. And, you know, we're going to continue to push on the Senate to try to move that bill. Personally, I don't think that they should allow the filibuster to stand in the way of women's reproductive freedom. Beyond that, you know, there are real concerns about what this could mean for other rights to privacy. You had both in the Griswold case and the Eisenstadt case under the Supreme Court, a right to birth control. Under the decision, or at least the leaked decision that came from the court, that could be called into question. And so I think it's very important that we stand up for people's reproductive freedom, for people's rights. And, you know, at the end of the day, what it may take in the Senate is getting more Democrats elected in November so that there are the votes to pass these important bills.
You've been a politician for a long time. You've been legislating for a long time. Take us to D.C. right now and what it's like to keep passing these bills, keep having Republicans block them, not getting anywhere, contradictions left and right. It has to be frustrating for someone like you who generally seems to enjoy what they're doing and you're quite jovial about the work. It's got to be soul sucking to feel like you're not getting much done, or at least, you know, to those of us over here in the other Washington, we're going, what is happening over in D.C.? They can't agree on anything.
Well, listen, I'm not a hand wringer. We just keep fighting for the folks we represent. And you know, you asked earlier about the, you know, the dark MAGA or whatever. It is concerning to me when you see things that are common sense that end up being partisan.
Yeah.
You know, the funding for baby formula being a great example of that. For the life of me. I mean, I would be honest with you if I could come up with a rationale for why people would vote no on that. I can't understand why someone would vote no on that. The House last week passed a bill focused on preventing domestic terrorism and rooting out white supremacists and trying to prevent any sort of domestic terrorism. For the life of me, I cannot understand why someone would vote against that. And yet you saw it be a nearly party line vote. That does not make a lot of sense to me.
Did you ask Republicans their reasons why? Did they not give you a reason?
Well, there was certainly floor debate and you had people say, well, there's not a real issue here or things like that. But I just don't think that's grounded in fact. Having said that, I also think that there are areas where I am hopeful that we will make progress. So one is the Competes Act, which is this American competitiveness bill that I think will have a really positive impact over the long haul on American manufacturing, on making things here in the United States, and on addressing inflation. You know, one of the things that we've seen that has dramatically impacted prices is supply chain disruption, specifically related to chips, to semiconductors. You know, the United States invented the microchip, and now we only produce 10% of them. And so there's a bill that was bipartisan in the Senate, was slightly more partisan in the House. But right now there's negotiation happening between the House and the Senate, between Democrats and Republicans, that would, among other things, increase domestic manufacturing of chips. That's a big deal because that's in everything from automobiles to appliances, so much of what we depend on. And because of some of those global shortages, because of some of those supply chain disruptions, we've seen our prices go up. You know, I'll give one other example of something that I think should not have been partisan, but I'm hopeful we'll make it through the Senate. Last week, we passed a bill that was sponsored where the lead author was from here in Washington, Kim Schreier, focused on preventing price gouging by oil and gas companies. You know, the reality is people are being pinched by rising gas prices. And I don't think there's a silver bullet to addressing that. There's a lot of levers we need to pull. But the fact that major oil companies are posting record profits, that even when the price per barrel has gone down, prices at the pump have stayed high, suggests that there is value in empowering the Federal Trade Commission to go after exploitation, to go after price gouging. And that to me should not be a partisan issue. This is about protecting consumers. It's about lowering the cost of gas for Americans at the pump.
Sixth District Congressman Derek Kilmer. Congressman, thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks to you guys.
Choke Points, brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. We're going to talk about the chaos in West Seattle, not the bridge, the ferry terminal. It doesn't do the job anymore, and Chris has the latest on the replacement project.
And Dave, you know this better than any of us, because you use that facility all the time, that old terminal, it needs to go. It just doesn't do what it needs to anymore. The state ferries, Hadley Rodero, agrees.
It's got timber piling that need to be replaced. It is not built to current seismic standards, and it's also a really small dock. The dock holds 80 cars. The ferries that serve that route hold 124 cars.
So it's become a nightmare for the neighborhood. Cars lined up and down Fauntleroy. And this is the only state ferry dock that's actually serviced by a local street. And as we said, just doesn't work anymore. So the state's been researching about 15 or so options for replacing the terminal, and Rodero says the final ideas are coming into focus.
15 alternatives that have been suggested over the years by community members, kind of a broad range of ideas that we've now taken a look at and applied some fatal flaw criteria to.
One of the options was to move the terminal out of West Seattle. but that would have greatly reduced the service.
We did look at moving the terminal. Some people had suggested Burien, Des Moines, moving it to downtown Seattle where our Bainbridge and Bremerton routes come into downtown. And we looked at those and decided that those options just are not feasible.
So that had a fatal flaw in it. So that's off the board. So the state's now looking at what they can do, not necessarily inside the existing footprint, but inside the existing area.
It's a variation on different sizes of the dock over the water and different ways to manage the traffic on the city streets. So we've got a smaller dock, a medium-sized dock, a larger dock, and those are the alternatives that we'll be studying further.
So the dock could either go further out into the water, they might make it fatter, make it wider so they could add the lanes that way. They're looking at maybe one holding lane designated all the way up Fauntleroy, maybe two lanes. I'm not sure how they would do that, but you can look at the options here at the links I've put up at mynorthwest.com to kind of figure out exactly what you'd like. And Rodero says the state really would like the public input so they can nail down what works best.
A chance to click through all the alternatives that we're talking about and share your thoughts about issues that we should consider as we dive deeper into the planning process and further study these alternatives. So we want to hear about what issues matter most to the community, what concerns you may have about certain alternatives.
There are two virtual public meetings that you can also attend. The first one is this afternoon at noon. There's another one at 6 p.m. tomorrow night. You can find the links to register for those events at mynorthwest.com as well. They really need your input to try to figure out what they can do to make this work for not only you guys, the ferry riders, but also the people who live there in the community around the dock.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. A Brooklyn speech and debate teacher was on the verge of going broke after spending thousands of dollars of his own money to help his students compete in Ivy League tournaments, until a popular Instagram page caught wind of his story.
There's no such thing as tough kids. It's kids who are going through something tough.
One of those kids was Jonathan Conyers. Teacher K.M. DeColandria, who goes by Deco, tells NBC New York she was starting out as a high school teacher in Harlem. Deco introduced Conyers to the world of speech and debate, and a couple of Ivy League tournaments later, Conyers earned a full-ride college scholarship and a way out of poverty.
I want to be people's Deco. I want to continue to give back to my community.
As you can hear, Deco inspiring his students, but it turns out Deco needed some help of his own. Shortly before the pandemic, he started a nonprofit, Brooklyn Debate League, to help prepare underprivileged students for debate tournaments.
And I didn't think it was fair that folks that already had the financial means and probably were going to the fancier schools were getting this heads up in middle school.
On the surface, the Brooklyn Debate League was flourishing, but on paper, the teacher had to take out $6,000 of his savings to keep the program going.
We were broke. I had poured money into this. We were under broke.
And that's when Humans of New York got involved. Conyers, a former student of the teacher, opened up about his past and how it was his speech and debate coach who changed his life for the better.
It was the biggest way I think I can really dedicate this to Deco.
And it was because of that story that the Humans of New York fundraising page set up for the Brooklyn Debate League raised $1 million.
The people of New York and around the world have stepped up and shown their love. The sky's the limit. Like, let's go. Like, let's do all the things we wanted to do.
Always inspiring. Do you follow that page?
That's the guy
social?
Who goes around just interviewing people and getting their stories. Right.
Yeah. And they have little micro fashion posts for the little ones. But yeah, always inevitably it turns into this fundraising effort that just raves gobs of money. But we got to get to traffic, don't we?
Yes, we do. I like the way this man wears his fanny pack. It is a 749. G is here from G and Ursula.
Wait a minute.
So Dave, you're wearing it under the arm.
That's right.
Well, cross the body.
You cross the body. You can do it however you want to. But I just got to say, out of all the things that I've ever worn here at Cairo, this is the first time that I feel like I finally got approval from Dave Ross.
It's so hard to do.
What is it about what I'm wearing today that did it?
It's because I would like to carry a man purse, but I've never figured out a manly way to do it. And it looks like you've discovered it. Because I like to have, you know, a few provisions standing by and a better place to put the wallet and the cell phone than in the back pocket.
Because, when you sit down, you're like crooked
exactly.
When you have it in your back pocket. Exactly. So, you've got to get the crossbody fanny pack I sent you a couple models, but gee, here.
And frankly, I mean, I see the way you dress. And I figure if you wear it, it must be in style.
So I got some at home. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring you one.
Really?
That I think would fit you.
You think so, huh?
Yeah.
He's right. Going to dress you.
I'll give it a try. Yeah.
You give it a try? Yeah. Yeah.
I'll give it a try.
I'm starting to look like you, too. I got the beard. Yeah, right. Just like
you. You two are slowly morphing into
nice
one another.
Nice try.
What are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about the Seahawks because I hear that OTAs, which stands for Organized Training Activity,
yes,
is underway. And there's going to be a quarterback competition, right?
Yeah, that's the number one story.
Okay. So how long does that take? And what are you looking for? I mean, how do you predict how a guy is going to perform under pressure, especially when he's replacing a Hall of Famer?
Right. Well, number one, it's hard, right? It's hard for them to do because you can't predict anything until you get on the field. It's kind of like preparing to do a radio show, right? I mean, you could do all the preparation you want. You don't know until the show happens, right? Well, when it comes to the competition between Drew Locke and Geno Smith, obviously the person that's leading the competition right now is Geno Smith, because Geno Smith has been here. He has he's been in the system. He's been here for a few years, so arguably he has the edge up on Drew Locke. However, the trade for Drew Locke ultimately is for Drew Locke to win the job. Now, if he doesn't win the job, then he doesn't win the job. I mean, then Geno Smith wins.
Does he go to backup then, or does he get traded away?
No. He goes to backup. But the idea is that that Drew Locke was traded for to come here and absolutely start, like to take advantage of that. So hopefully he is doing his thing and doing his job well enough to where he can be the guy come week one. I believe that that's what the Seahawks want. Sometimes that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you want to go to prom with that one person, mm-hmm. but then it didn't happen, and then you go to prom with somebody else.
Are there any teams that double date? As in, you have two quarterbacks who are equally good, and any Sunday, either one of them could start.
Ooh. Yeah, that's the only works in junior football.
I see. Nobody does.
And for some reason, you ever notice that the coach's kid is always the quarterback? That's another story. but yeah, that doesn't happen in the pros. You need to have that consistency on who you're going to get. Look, it is hard to follow Russell Wilson. That is going to be tough. So the expectations are there. Even when I said that Geno Smith is leading the competition, probably because he's been here, I even felt the energy from Colleen right away when I said that. Colleen, what was I feeling there? Am I right? Did I feel the energy?
Yeah, you
see?
Are.
Right.
I'm trying to get excited about the team, but it's much like the Mariners for me, where I feel like I've lost track of who they are, what their personalities are, their storylines, and I'm having a hard time getting excited about the upcoming season.
That is the number one thing, and that's why the NFL is king, right? And it's that way because of the personalities. And one of the things that we've been spoiled with here in this town has been the personalities. And, oh, by the way, they were really good at football. So you had
Chancellor, Marshawn Lynch, yes. Russell Wilson. Let's not forget Richard Sherman.
Wait a minute, though, Colleen. We are now in a new relationship now.
Okay.
We can't think about the ex. We can't think about the past.
Then help me get to know them, because I don't feel like I'm making a connection.
All right. Well, we just talked about that. Let me give you someone else to get to know. Jordan Brooks. Jordan Brooks, who is now going into his third year. He was a first-round draft pick by the Seahawks. He's going to be middle linebacker. He's going to be a linebacker. He's going to be the guy. Ultimately, he's kind of replacing Bobby Wagner. Just found out yesterday he is going to be the one that will wear the green dot on his helmet. And what does that mean?
What does it mean?
That means he has a communication device in his helmet that he's going to relay to play calls that comes in from the coaches, and he makes the adjustments out there on the field. So he's able to get direct communication from the coaches. So Jordan Brooks, who is I got to tell you, he's a really good player.
Keep your eye on the green dot. Thank you, G. G and Ursula, 9 o'clock. On Tuesdays, we go live to the nation's capital and New York Times investigative reporter David Farenthold. The big political news today, of course, the primaries in five states, including your home state, Texas, and this apparently is the last call for the Bush dynasty, huh?
Well, you don't know that yet. We'll know tonight. There is a runoff in the primary Republican primary for the Texas Attorney General, where George P. Bush, who has kind of a powerful state position called land commissioner now, is running against the incumbent, Ken Paxton. Ken Paxton, the current incumbent attorney general, is under indictment. He's been under indictment for years. He's been denounced by the state bar of Texas. His own lawyers have condemned him. But I think everyone expects him to win and beat George P. Bush because it's a very hard right Republican electorate, and he has done the right things, especially in terms of currying the favor of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And George P. Bush is the son of Jeb, right?
Yes, he's the son of Jeb. You may remember Jeb obviously was treated quite poorly by Donald Trump, and Jeb, who does not have a future in politics, has been pretty negative about Trump. But George P., who still hopes to have a future, has been very positive about the man who basically destroyed his father's career.
Yeah. Now, if he were to win, I mean, does he have higher political ambitions, or are they confined simply to the state of Texas?
I think that George P. Bush, like, his whole MO is higher political aspirations. He's wanted a higher office for a long time. And yes, I think he would want to look to be governor or senator or something beyond the state of Texas. But he's first got to win. This is his most high-profile race, and we don't know how he's going to do. I would pick him to be the underdog at this point.
Yeah. Okay, the other big state for primaries, of course, is Georgia. I see that Trump's pick, David Perdue, is like 22% behind Brian Kemp. That doesn't look good for Perdue.
No, this is an interesting race because obviously Georgia was a key battleground in 2020, and the Republican governor, Brian Kemp, the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, stood up to Trump, told him he lost, refused his request. You remember, can't you find the 11,000 votes? Trump said that to them, you know, can't you find 11,000 votes so I can win? They stood up, Trump lost Georgia, and he's been on a revenge tour ever since. This is probably the most prominent target of his revenge tour, Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger. And I would say both of them are favorites to win. Kemp is a major favorite over David Perdue, the former senator, who was Trump's pick. Raffensperger is in a tighter race against a really hard Trump acolyte. But there's been a lot of crossover voting by Democrats in that race. And so I would, you know, they're all voting Raffensperger, I assume. So I would presume that that means Raffensperger is the favorite.
Okay. And Mike Pence was down there campaigning for Kemp. Now, are they genuinely friends, or is Pence trying to send a signal to Donald Trump?
I think Pence is trying to carve out an identity for himself after Donald Trump. I mean, he was, until January 6th, he was Trump's, you know, closest enabler. Remember him talking about Trump's broad shoulders and his bold vision for America? And then he wouldn't do what Trump wanted on January 6th. He wouldn't let Trump steal the election. So now I think Pence is trying to carve out a new identity that's not anti-Trump, but not, you know, in Trump on Trump's coattails anymore. Part of that is supporting Kemp, who, if Trump had never happened, Kemp and Pence are very compatible, both very sort of Christian conservative Republicans.
Yeah. Okay. On the Trump beat, I got a couple of questions for you. First of all, the dark MAGA comment that's surfaced, I think Madison Cawthorn put that up on Twitter. I've been asking everybody who's remotely connected to politics, what is dark MAGA? Do you know what it is?
That was a new one to me. It's for everyone who doesn't know. Madison Cawthorn, the Republican freshman in North Carolina who became infamous, famous for a lot of things, most recently saying that Republican congressmen engaged in cocaine-fueled orgies on Capitol Hill, lost. And the Republican establishment turned on him. Madison Cawthorn lost last week. And afterward, he said, you know, I'm done being nice. You know, the Republican establishment is after me. It's time to unleash dark MAGA, which apparently is some sort of, like, very online term for sort of, you know, not evil, I suppose, but aggressive, rule-breaking Trump followers. And they believe that they've been playing nice all along, and now it's time to not play nice. That said, I don't think he has very much support behind him. He lost in his own district and his own party. So it may just, you know, that statement by Cawthorn may just be sort of empty bluster. You know, so I heard someone compare him to a Molgoth. You know, he was trying to be very, very dark and scary, but I'm not sure who's behind him.
Okay, so we don't know what, by not being nice, we don't know what that means. I mean, I'm worried that somebody's going to start getting physical.
Well, I mean, they already were. I feel like that's the sort of funny thing about it. Trump was telling people to assault people at his rallies.
Yeah, I know.
You know, Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. So I suppose that's the sort of dark MAGA is there's a threat of violence there. But, I mean, I don't think it's something that anybody's listening to Madison Cawthorn and his called out seemed targeted at the Republican Party more than anybody else.
Yeah. The other thing is Trump has now appeared on Truth Social, that new unrestricted social media site where you don't retweet, you retruth. And he retruthed a comment apparently calling for civil war. Now, is that what we're talking about when we're talking about not being nice? And first of all, I mean, what do you think that story is? Is there any substance to that? Again, is this something that we have to worry about or not?
I mean, I am very worried about Trump in general. Obviously, the last time he ran for president, when he lost, he tried to destroy American democracy. And, you know, from what he's saying and doing now, I don't have any more doubts. That's what he would do again. If it meant when, you know, if he lost another election, then he would try to destroy American democracy again. You know, the thing about civil war, this reminds me of like 2015, you know, where Trump was, you know, when everyone was first paying attention to Trump's Twitter account, and he'd retweet people saying all kinds of things. We'd spend a lot of time saying, well, what did he mean by that? What was he saying? I don't think he means, I mean, we now have seen Trump's mind operating enough to know that I don't think he puts a lot of thought into anything like that. At most, he may be just doing it because he knows it gets a rise out of people. If, you know, if I was him and I wanted people to pay attention to Truth Social, which they're not really doing now, I would retweet all kinds of crazy stuff because I want people to be on there being like, oh, what's he going to do next?
You would not. You would fact check it first at the very least. You'd run it by the New York Times fact-checking department before you send it out to the millions of people.
When I start my own social network, I'm going to be a different person, I promise.
Yeah, oh, great. All right, now to your new beat on the New York Times, which is investigating charitable organizations that raise big amounts of money. I saw a story about Black Lives Matter, and this is actually from the Daily Mail. And I don't know if you've seen the story, but it basically hints that the founder of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Cullors, several allegations. She paid her baby father $970,000 for creative services. I'm quoting from the Mail here. She paid her brother $840,000 for security, a fellow director $2.1 million, and reimbursed the organization $73,000 for a charter flight. The implication being that she's misusing the organization's funds. So as a professional investigator of charities, what do you think about this?
It's a really interesting topic. I've read that story. I haven't done any of my own research yet into that organization, but it's the kind of thing that I do want to tackle. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the Tea Party groups from 2012. Mm-hmm. Remember how people got, or 2010, there was so much interest in the Tea Party. And if you started a group called Tea Party Patriots or whatever, you got a ton of money. And those people really lived well for years afterward off all the money that had flooded in because they had the name everyone was interested in. So, you know, Black Lives Matter, obviously, you know, is a bigger movement than just this one nonprofit. But if this one nonprofit now has a bunch of money that people are using to sort of, you know, line their own pockets, that's really interesting to me. So it's something that's on my list.
Well, they're going to claim that, hey, we're a big organization, so we have a right to rent decent-looking facilities and pay people a meaningful wage.
Totally. And I mean, that's why you need to look into it more. It's a big organization that has a famous name and a lot of money. So that's the kind of organization I want to look at.
All right. David Farenthold from the New York Times. David, thank you.
Thank you.
You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here's Rachel Bell to complain about the high cost of babysitters.
I'm not here to complain. I am childless by choice. I mean, this is not affecting me. And I want to make sure that this segment doesn't turn into a back in my day, we charged, you know. But babysitters are raking it in right now. This article, I believe in the Wall Street Journal, says that teen babysitters are charging $35 an hour. And the headline is because they can.
This is your new side gig.
Seriously. I mean, I don't want children, so I probably don't want to watch somebody else's anymore. But when I was a kid, I was a huge babysitter. But in this article, there's story after story after story from teenagers all over the country saying before the pandemic, I made $10 an hour, $15 an hour. Now I'm charging $20, $25, $30, $35. But it's not just that. It's that the parents, they say in this article, are just so thankful because they've been with their kids nonstop for the past 2 years that sometimes they are saying, no, let me give you more money. And they're thanking them to this point where they're like, you're welcome. It's okay. It's fine.
Are they going above and beyond? Because for $30, $35, I'd expect them to bring a craft.
No.
Teach them a foreign language.
Probably not.
Make them dinner.
Yeah, probably that. Okay. It says that parents have less expectations than before and are paying more. So before it might be watch the kids and then when they go to bed, could you please do the dishes? Now they're not doing that. And a lot of these babysitters are saying, then they're saying order whatever you want on DoorDash. So they're getting like a free dinner, but not just, you know, what we used to make, Kraft mac and cheese from the pantry. They can order, I don't know, sushi from wherever they want to. Care.com, which is a babysitting website, said that on average, its site is charging $18.05 an hour in April. And 2 years ago, it was about $14. So it's going up everywhere. And on top of this, they're saying that more teens are working outside of babysitting, you know, at jobs more than ever before as well, because the pay is so high. You know, people are having such a hard time, especially at restaurants, that not only is the pay higher, but the skill level is being lowered because they need people so badly. And these teens are like, I can do that now.
This is paradise.
I couldn't help but thinking about how much teachers make and wondering, you know, do some teachers think it's worth it just to babysit at these rates? You know, I mean, you hear for years and years how little money we're paying teachers and what an important job it is. And maybe it would be better for them to get $40 bucks an hour to babysit.
They don't
under
get
the table.
They don't get health care.
That's true.
Yeah, that's the next thing they'll be asked for is benefits.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I have a friend who was a nanny in Chicago. She's about my age and she's nannied for years because she does improv. And some of the families did give her health care and paid sick time and paid vacation.
That makes sense if it's like a full-time nanny gig. Yeah.
Boy, I am way undercharging for being a grandparent.
I provide really
skilled care, including doing nap time, preparing food, fun games, you know, reading, doing a personal reading of, you know, children's books to the child while the child's on my lap.
Multiple kids voices. Don't pay you at all?
Well,
no.
I'm sure they give you like seven Werther's Originals every hour?
I get a homemade pizza from time to time.
There you go.
That's not grandpa enough. You got to really get in there. Three tubes of Bengay a day.
This is how messed up the child care situation is, though. So my mom, watched Elliot on Fridays, my oldest, for 5 years until she entered kindergarten. And we were going to do the same thing with June until the pandemic hit. But then now that it's cooling down, she's like, hey, do you think I can come over on Fridays? We did the math with June's daycare center. And we would either have to charge my mom $25 every Friday that she watches June to cover the cost of saving June's spot in case she ever comes back on Fridays.
So your mom would have to pay you to watch her.
We would only save $25 a month. So it either is going to cost us $100 a month or my mom would have to pay me $25.
Could your mom just hang out at daycare so she can see you there?
Yeah,
exactly. I thought that was so messed up that you can't even save money by having a grandparent watch your child.
That's ridiculous.
Because you would lose your spot at the daycare.
Over the weekend, I was investigating having a kid in the neighborhood come and feed my cat sometimes because I've never paid anyone. I just like, you know, someone stops by. But recently, I mean, it's a little bit of a drive, but thank you.
I love kitties.
And so somebody put up on this Facebook group in my neighborhood, oh, my 14-year-old kid wants to start pet sitting. Send me a message. So I said, how much do they charge? And I know this isn't going to sound like a lot, but I thought that it was for being 14.
Yeah.
I said, all it is you come in, you put the food in the bowl, you leave. That's it. No dog walking, no nothing.
Cats are easy.
$10 every time they come over. So it was like $20 a day to put the cat food in the bowl. I don't know. That seemed high to me.
How many days?
Well, just however many, like per time they come, $10.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah.
So I think cats
these just days. Train your cat to get his own food.
Oh, by the way, it's a girl. Thank you.
Trained her to get her own food.
She's
sorry.
Gorgeous. We like to say, so she when I got her at the pound, they said, oh, we got this litter of kittens. They were in a dumpster. And she's so beautiful now. We say, from garbage to gorgeous, the Poppy story.
Well, that's an Instagram account right there.
It should be.
True.
Yeah. Make the cat famous and the cat will pay for herself.
That's true. Grumpy Cat did it. Why can't you, Poppy? Sing for your supper.
Exactly right. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.